On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Danny Jansen about the topic of divine wrath and atonement and all things related to it. So we cover topics like, what is divine wrath? Does God have emotions? What's the historical understanding of divine wrath, particularly in Reformation thought? What are the implications of the biblical language surrounding wrath? How is that functioning for our theological concepts? And what is ultimately the relationship between wrath, justice, and the cross, and much, much more?
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I'm alongside my co-host, Jacob Denhollander, and we're a podcast that's devoted to serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we've endeavored to create or encourage at least an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. That's a mouthful for basically just saying we want to be really nice people that think about Christian topics in a Christian way. And that leads us to talk to all sorts of people across the spectrum, people we disagree with, people we agree with, people we don't know what they think, and then we find out in surprising ways that we either agree or don't agree. And sometimes there's crazy people, and sometimes there's really cool, interesting things we had no idea about. So it's a lot of fun to talk to all sorts of people. And this episode in particular, I'm excited about because it's a question that I've thought about, and I know Jacob's thought a lot about it. And it's the problem of divine wrath and atonement and things that are related to it. And so I'm excited to introduce you all to Dr. Danny Jansen, and we're going to be talking about her work on this, which is very, very interesting. And they also have, I think, a forthcoming, or she and Aaron, my friend Aaron, have like a forthcoming, I don't know, special symposium or something with Philosophia Christi. So I'm excited to see that in print in due course. That's edited by our friend Ross Inman, so I'm excited. That'll be fun. Before we jump into the topic, Danny, tell me a little bit about yourself. What was it that got you interested? Because you wrote a whole dissertation on this topic. I mean, that's a lot of time and effort. You know, you've got to like your topic. So I'd be interested to see, like, what was the motivating factor for it?
Yeah, I just recently got my PhD at the University of St. Andrews, supervised by Stephen Holmes. And like you said, my dissertation was on the intersection of divine wrath and the atonement. Currently, I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Birmingham with the psychology and theology cross-training program. And I also teach Christian ethics here, co-teach Christian ethics with Dr. John Perry at the University of St. Andrews. So what made me interested in wrath? Yeah. So when I was doing my master's degree, a theology professor, a mentor of mine, and I spent hours and hours talking about the atonement and talking about penal substitutionary atonement specifically, as there seemed to be a lot more rhetoric coming from theologian pastors saying things like God killed his son. And it seemed to be quite concerning to both of us. And this is, you know, directly linked to the idea of God's wrath. And so from those conversations, I just started to question, like, what is God's wrath? What is it? What is anger? And so I knew when I wanted to apply for a PhD that that would kind of be the springing off point for what I wanted to study.
Awesome. Yeah, I need to get Steve Holmes on the podcast at some point.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like he's somebody that a lot of our listeners would be interested in hearing from. Hmm. So in this topic, though, I think a lot of the, you know, when people talk about divine wrath and they bring up some of these evangelical examples, some people might think it's caricature, and then you find out, oh, it's actually real. So just talk to me a little bit about baseline, like when we say divine wrath, what is divine wrath? And then I'd be interested in hearing you sort of cash out this distinction between an effect and an affect when it comes to wrath.
Right. So in PSA literature, so I specifically focus in on PSA because divine wrath features prominently in the articulation of the doctrine. So out of all the atonement models out there, this one specifically rests on some concept of God's wrath. And within the literature, it's comes down to two ways of understanding. It's either an effect or an affect, as you mentioned. So an effect of would be it's an effect of God's will. right? And this is connected with the idea that it's an effect of God's retributive justice. And that's also connected with when we see it in the context of the cross, that retributive justice is executed and satisfied through the work of Christ. And this is seen in the suffering of Christ. So whether the forms of the doctrine argue that Christ is punished or that Christ takes on the penal consequences of sin in lieu of the sinner, that suffering is an effect of God's will on God's retributive justice. And then there's also another way that within this literature, it discusses that it's an affect. It's actually an emotional experience of some sort within the divine life. And so this is kind of where you hear the idea of righteous wrath, that God has righteous anger and God has anger, but it's free from sin somehow, however we want to talk about that. So those are two main ways of looking at it, although within the literature, it's not easily distinguished. Some, they go in and out of each other. The effect and the affect are sometimes talked at the same time, but those are two main ways in which this idea is conceived.
One of the things that you really brought out in your dissertation and kind of goes into what you were just speaking about was that there's often a confused way of speaking about wrath in the literature or ways that are not exactly that don't get into the different nuances, that don't recognize the different nuances. In your research, what would you say is the way that wrath functions rhetorically in these communities that might sometimes contribute to that confusion?
Right. Now, this is not speaking for all accounts of PSA. I'm going to make that very clear. There are various accounts of PSA out there. But in certain forms, the rhetoric gets quite heavy, quite appetitive when it talks about God's wrath. And so we're using this emotional language about anger, and we have this idea that somehow God pours out wrath, that God extinguishes God's wrath on Christ, that Christ becomes the object of God's wrath or hatred even. And I understand that we want to explain that there is a seriousness issue with sin. It's very serious, and that God deals seriously with sin. But I think that at times within this literature, it becomes so emotive. It becomes so visceral, the way that we're explaining what God's wrath is, that it becomes quite dangerous with how we're wanting to understand who God is in relation to other kind of theological commitments that one might have about the doctrine of God. Can God feel emotion? Almost universally, I think in PSA literature, the argument isn't that God is passible, that we have an impassible God. So how those two things square is, I think, needs to be dealt with, but also what else we are communicating with certain verbiage within the literature. How is this being described? It seems quite human, and it makes almost divine wrath like a substance. And so, again, not all accounts, definitely not all accounts, but we do see that in the literature.
Yeah, and I think that that's important. That's one of the contributions that you really make here. Is that there are different accounts of penal substitutionary atonement, and that's not often acknowledged. And I really like the phrase that you used was appetitive, that God has an appetite for wrath, that sometimes is spoken of as something he needs to get out. What are some dangers? Because one of the things that I think happens is that with the belief in wrath is used as kind of a touchstone in certain evangelical contexts as, you know, well, I really take sin seriously. I really take the Bible seriously. And so sometimes there's not a check and balance on that language of wrath. And it almost seems that sometimes people will try to outdo each other in talking about how seriously they take wrath. What are some dangers vis-a-vis other doctrines that can happen or that can present themselves when we have a kind of unchecked emotive understanding of wrath?
Yeah, well, there are many. And I think that issues have been raised for decades now about this. But within the literature, when you read accounts of PSA and we get in quite emotive terms, it's very difficult to understand how this squares with other, like I said, theological commitments. So most PSA defenders would fall in line with kind of just a general classical theist view of the doctrine of God, right? God is not moved outside of God's self. God is, again, not motivated outside of God's self. God doesn't change, however you want to understand how God can or does change. But with those kind of touchstone pieces within the doctrine of God, once you start throwing in emotive language, I think it's really important that you become very clear and very concise with how you are using this emotive language. And pastorally speaking, and we've seen this, like, I mean, Jonathan Edwards is, you know, one of those cases. It's just that pastorally speaking, you want to get across something very serious, but in doing so, it does damage to the way that I think that one understands who God is on the whole. And if we're going to use anger, the whole point of what I wanted to study is I wanted to understand emotion, because within these discussions, emotion is not discussed. What are we talking about when we're talking about an emotion? And then what are we talking about anger? And how is it that we can attribute these two things to the divine life? And if we want to stay somewhat classical theist, that's an issue, particularly what we know to be true about emotion. So I'm not a pastor. I get pastor theologians have congregations to look at, and there's way that this is articulated. So it's not always the same within like scholarly work, but it is an issue. And I don't think you have to be serious about sin by exaggerating an anger issue that God may have against sin. I think that's important.
Yeah, there's multiple things that I want to follow up on. One of those pieces is the emotional aspect here. I think you're exactly right that when people talk about wrath, they're including a concept of emotion, but they're not actually articulating it or expanding on what it is. So I'd be curious, in your mind, I mean, is it proper to say divine wrath is some sort of emotional state within the life of God, or is it something completely distinct, at least as it's been articulated in the past?
So in my work, I look at what emotion is, and within, if we bring it to the impassibility debate, this is where you see a lot of this, where within the literature on both sides, passibility or impassibilist, there's a jumping off point where we want to talk about either God suffers or God has emotion. And rarely, if ever, is there any engagement in a serious definition of emotion. And so usually the jumping off point is some kind of folk understanding what emotion is, or, and this is usually intertwined, it's based off of kind of classical discussions that come from the idea of passions, affections, feelings, you know, mainly, you know, from Aquinas or Augustine, and they kind of throw it all into this idea, this term, this omnibus term of emotion, and then jump off from there. And I think what is important to realize is that the term emotion, the idea, the concept of emotion did not arrive until the late 18th century. And so from then, that is when this idea of emotion happened. Previously, if we're talking about, you know, classical works, theological works, we're talking about, like I said, passions and affections and desire of the will and the will of God and virtues. And these are theological concepts that are discussed and understanding who God is and who human beings are and how human beings relate to one another and relate to God. This is a whole, system of trying to understand who people are, right? And to live rightly with each other and with God. But once the term emotion got on, once secular psychology started to take root in the late 18th century and on, emotion is not synonymous with a passion or affection or desire of the will at all. It is a completely different term. And so within certain theological works and philosophy of religion works is that this idea of emotion still has a hangover, right, from previous classical accounts of how we understand what's happening inside of us as humans, but not giving attention to the contemporary science on emotion. And if that's the case, I feel like we're confusing different concepts and we're letting the reader also take up their folk understanding of what emotion means and how that is interpreted and then understand that, you know, whatever they're reading in light of that. So my goal was to look at this, see what current psychology has to say about this and how we understand emotion today, not as a theological concept, but what is actually happening within us, and how that might inform then our theological understanding about emotion and then in turn, anger and wrath.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I want to follow up here just on literature on emotion. I mean, yeah. I feel like I've read a decent amount of literature on this, and I still feel woefully inadequate to understand what an emotion is. Mm-hmm. Are there any go-to resources that you would say, if you want to understand this in like one or two places, where would we go for that?
Yeah. Your confusion is not unwarranted. I mean, basically, it's just widely known within just the field of emotion that there is no definition that is widely accepted with actually no clear end in sight. And so many different disciplines are involved in this, everything from neuroscientists to anthropologists. So depending on who you go to, you're going to get a different perspective. And each of them are producing, I mean, amazing work on emotion and how this all comes together. So I don't have a very good go-to. Not that if I say, if you read this article or read this book, you'll understand the lay of the land. And that's why I understand why it's so difficult. But within the field, I would say that broadly speaking, this is very broad. There are two ways to look at this kind of research. And one is this non-cognitive approach. And then one is cognitive. So again, generally speaking, non-cognitive approaches focuses on kind of the neurological workings of what is happening when you experience emotion. Like what is in your brain, what's firing off while you experience an emotion. Also, you have anthropologists and evolutionary psychologists and of the sort who are saying that this is a learned behavior, that depending on your culture and your society, you learn to have certain emotions. And so that's part of it. Also, you have those who say that somatic responses are part of your emotion. When you're angry, your eyes narrow, your lips may purse, you might start sweating, those sorts of things. So these are highly dependent on a brain and a body. So I would assume that if we're going to try to find a good analogy to the divine life, we can just kind of set those aside, right? We're going to working what makes the most sense if we're just going to try to make an analogy here. So the cognitive approach I found to be the most interesting. And basically the cognitive is, again, they don't all agree. They don't all have the same finer details, but they are looking at emotion as something that is highly informed by our beliefs and our values and our past experiences, and that our emotions, the emotions that are produced, are based off of those things. And so you would call that an emotion is a value judgment. So I feel angry when I see an injustice happen based off of my beliefs and my values and what I hold to be close to me and how I may be invested in the situation or the person. That is my anger. I'm making a judgment. There needs to be justice. So within the literature, I've tried in what I did with my dissertation is I've narrowed it down to this idea that emotions are value judgments. So when we're talking about the divine life and your question of whether or not God has an emotional experience, if we're going to just maintain classical theism, just for the sake of argument, I think that the best way to understand this is that God is communicating to his people, to us, his value judgment. And that judgment is there's injustice over here and I care about this and this needs to be righted. Not that he experiences any kind of emotional experience within the divine life, but that it is a communication of a value judgment, which is through anger, the use of anger. So
I like this conclusion because okay. Independently of these two things, I would affirm both classical theism and that emotion is a cognitive sort of value judgment. So like, it makes me happy because I'm like, oh, maybe I'm right. If these both fit together, okay. Is there a reason I shouldn't want to accept sort of a cognitive value judgment sort of based emotion approach?
I don't think so. Okay. I think the alternatives, as far as I'm concerned, it then makes the idea of like if we're going to make an analog to the divine life, we would have to do so much reworking. It would make emotion unrecognizable to contemporary science. Absolutely. And at that point, like how much of our language is actually doing anything in trying to, you know, have some sort of idea of God and who God is. I feel like it begins to fall apart. And that's why I feel like a value judgment gives content to what we're trying to understand. Wrath is that if God does not have a body and brain, which I don't know any PSA defender to think that God is embodied or has a brain, then I'm proposing that this is a really good way to look at the analog, that there's no feeling in God, there's no substance pouring out of him. But when we see, when we're using the language of divine wrath, we are saying that God is communicating to us as people who understand what anger is. We understand the value of anger, of communicating that injustice is happening, that God is speaking to us in that way. And he is communicating that's unjust, that needs to be righted.
So one thing you mentioned early on in the dissertation is sort of the way that God's wrath captivates the imaginations of post-Reformation thinkers, or especially Christians. And I just want to know, like, why do you think that's the case? Mm-hmm. Did something happen to make them really interested in wrath, or what's going on there?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things, but one of the main reasons I see is that Reformation, post-Reformation thought was that Christ paid all of the debt of sin once and for all on the cross. Nothing else needs to happen, right? Christ took on all the penalty of sin for us, end of story. And in doing so, it's the penalty of sin is death, but it's not just bodily death. That it involves the final death. And once you get to working out how Christ paid the debt of final debt or death, you have to go into the idea of hell, right? And so traditionally speaking, that the punishment account of hell, which is everlasting punishment of either psychological and or bodily suffering or torture, which was widely held and is still widely held by conservative Protestants in North America. Then we have to work out how it is that Christ then paid the debt of everlasting torment in hell, right? And so hell is a place of God's wrath. And with that, how is it that Christ took on the penalty, that he took on that form of punishment on the cross, and it lifted the weight of debt and wrath from the redeemed? traditionally, it's understood that this is kind of a, for the post-Reformation, this is a coming from Calvin and his understanding about divine wrath, which I think has been shown has been widely misconstrued. And that might be a different topic, but I think that, so this idea that Christ took on the wrath of God on the cross, which is highly nuanced in Calvin's. In fact, Calvin doesn't think that wrath is a substance. Calvin does not think that God has an emotional state. In fact, Calvin thinks that divine wrath is an accommodation to humankind, that because of our sinful state, that we cannot know God as a God of love. We feel a sense, he says, there is a sense of condemnation and impending damnation that is on us as sinners until we see the love of Christ. And once we see the love of Christ, we no longer feel that weight. So it's just an effect, if we were talking about effects, right? But it was kind of taken a little bit differently. And so with the post-Reformation, and you see the kind of the works, let's just say for Owen, it's not everybody, not every post-Reformational PSA defender said these things. But in the case of Owen and being under attack by Socinius, and they're questioning, how is it that Christ actually paid this debt of hell, right? How is this? It got to this idea that the wrath of God was taken on by Christ, and Christ took on the quantitative and qualitative equivalent of that wrath that is experienced by the sinner in hell. He was quite extreme. Turretin said something similar, but only said the qualitative amount of wrath. But at that point, we're saying, hey, all this wrath that is for the sinner, this judgment, this punishment, Christ took it on. And so I don't know if it was like, I don't think it's an obsession or a fascination. I think it really became instrumental in how they wanted to articulate the atonement and articulate what it is that Christ did for us and how it is that we're no longer children of wrath, right? And so it just is a mainstay of the doctrine.
Well, I had just kind of a clarifying question of, so in a lot of PSA literature, the function of God's wrath is very clear. There's almost a numerative quality to it, where if, you know, humanity's sins, present and future, had brought up, you know, 100 sin points, so to speak, God put 100 sin points on Christ at the cross. There's a real substantive idea behind what God's wrath actually is. In your understanding, you know, where God's where wrath is God's moral evaluative judgment, I think that in a lot of PSA literature they would say yes, and there is something God's doing. There's a necessary doing on God's part where he recognizes, he makes this judgment, and then as part of that, there is his function as ruler or judge or governor of the world, in which he is then required to do something about it. In your understanding of wrath, is there something that God is doing in response to this? How does the cross function, if it does at all, with God's wrath? Is God's wrath in some way fixed at the cross, or is that something that stands apart from the cross? If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think two things. So first, I think it's important that there's a difference between, I mean, if you want to make God's wrath God's retributive justice, then God has done something. God's justice has been satisfied on the cross. But if you also want to couple that with the idea that there is something inside, like you said, some substance, something inside of God that must also be released. That's not just the satisfaction of justice. And to be clear, satisfaction, this is another issue, is that satisfaction of justice is not God is satisfied, something inside of him that needs to be satiated. It is the fulfillment that is Christ did enough to fulfill the demands of God's retributive justice. And so if that's important, is that if we want to say that, if we want to say God's wrath is synonymous with God's retributive justice, then we can say, we can look at the cross and say that it was satisfied, it's done. But if you also want to say, if you want to make divine wrath somehow separate from that, or like some kind of an extra execution of something else. If, I mean, because I feel like what you're getting at is that, like, if there's no wrath, then God's not doing something, right? And but I think that God has done something. There is justice, right, in the act of the atonement. I think that's clear, that Christ did fulfill God's justice. Now, if there's a way that you're thinking about God and that his anger has to be resolved and it's something extra and God needs to make people suffer, I mean, that's different. I think that's different. The retributive justice requires retributive punishment. And then you can say, we can see that punishment if you want to, or not everybody thinks it's punishment on the cross, that it's the penal consequences. We're saying God, Christ suffered. And I think that's what PSA is saying. Hey, we can actually see Christ suffer, and we want to understand why Christ is suffering. And we are saying that is the execution of divine wrath. And a lot of it, the violence of the atonement is something that Christians have struggled with since the beginning, trying to make sense of this torture, this instrument of torture is it integral to God's plan? Is it in redemption of humankind? How does this make sense? Right. And I think that PSA is saying, hey, listen, we want to try to understand this. We want to understand what the suffering is, and using kind of all the legal metaphors and the judgment and stuff, it's been bottled up into this doctrine. But if we're not clear with what we're talking about with divine wrath, Jacob, the question you had is the question it's a real question. But if we're not clear with what we're talking about, then you're left with like having divine wrath floating around as if it's God's emotion or an extra thing that needs to be extinguished or something.
Right. And sometimes you even it leads to a scenario where what the gospel show us as the passion event is somehow then becomes secondary to the real atonement, which is God pouring out his anger somehow, not often clearly defined, on the Son. And that's where the Son's real suffering. And so the execution by Jesus, by the leaders of the Jews and the Romans, sometimes even just fades in the atonement literature. And one thing that I do want to point out is that even in our confession, it speaks of God's justice being satisfied rather than wrath or anger. And I think that the value of your work here, I mean, there's a lot going for it, but I think that idea of really what do we mean by anger and wrath, because it leads to the situation where it's almost as if God is torturing his Son. The Father is torturing his Son at the cross, and that the suffering that Jesus experienced is for the Father's benefit.
Yeah, I mean, it can get pretty nasty like that in my perspective. I mean, yeah, not all accounts do that. And I think also going back to your original question, it's important that there is a distinction between an emotion and behavior. And especially in the cognitivist account, is that the behavior is not an emotion. And so I may experience anger at injustice. But what happens after that is not anger. It is a behavior in result of. And I think that's also important when we're talking about how we're understanding wrath and the cross, and that if we're identifying the suffering as if God's active involvement, which in the crucifixion somehow, you don't have to attribute what Christ suffered as if it's anger. That is a different aspect. Just because we can say that God is making a value judgment against injustice, it does not automatically lead to some form of behavior. It may be connect. There may be instances where you can connect certain forms of behavior that you want to say that God acted in human history, but that is, I feel like that distinction is important.
One thing I wanted to key in on is the necessity of the sort of like responding in anger or something like that. Because I think of people's accounts like Jonathan Rutledge, who's sort of argued that, you know, forgiveness and things like that don't require sort of a substitutionary mm-hmm. account of the atonement. So is there a problem with saying that, like, a penal substitutionary account may say that God must respond in this particular way to the cross or whatever other event?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of that has to do with, like we were talking about, seriousness of sin, but also this idea that if God is just, he must be angry at sin. If God is love, God must be angry at sin. And we do that because us as humans, we do that. I mean, if somebody hurts my son, no doubt I'm probably going to get angry. Because I love him and I want the best for him, and it's unjust if he didn't deserve it, then that's I'll get angry, right? But to say that God's justice demands anger, I think it doesn't follow, because justice, you do not have to be angry to get justice. I do not have to be angry to pursue justice. And that is a really important thing, because I think that once we attribute justice to anger, we get off track. I actually just saw something recently where somebody was trying to make the distinguish between discipline and punishment. And the argument was discipline's in love, but punishment is punitive and angry. And I thought, oh, wow. I mean, in penal theory, anger doesn't have anything to do with punishment. In fact, if you have a judge that's angry and delivers a punishment, I think we have an issue. I mean, you want a judge who is clear-headed on this, not somebody who's just built up with anger and wants to snap, right? And so making it a necessary connection that because God is just, God has to be angry, I think is inappropriate. And God doesn't have to be angry to be personal. And I think it's unfortunate that it comes down to that, because it sounds right to us, right? As when we think about our own situation and how we feel. But I think, like we've been talking about, other theological commitments also have to play in part in how we understand who God is. And connecting justice with anger is very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I'm still mulling over the section in Thomas Aquinas's Summa Contra Gentiles where he sort of likens God to an angry man, but then like qualifies it with 1,000 qualifications where it's like, well, it's not like any of that, but it's sort of like that. Right. And I thought maybe that's an appropriate way for me to think about it, to where, yeah, that's kind of an analog, but in no way do you understand it.
Yeah, I think, and that's why when I hear it's righteous anger, I just wanted to be like, well, what does that mean? And I think you get, like you said, you get to the so many qualifications that it just kind of loses all meaning. And that's with the work I've done about value judgment. I thought, okay, I feel like we can give content, like real content about what it is when we want to say, use this emotive language and how we're understanding where the analogy rests.
So So then the question I have relates to, you know, William Lane Craig's new account or new defense of penal substitutionary atonement. Where do you think it's adequate? Do you think it's an advancement? Do you think there are problems with it?
Yeah, I mean, it is the most sophisticated account that has been presented since John Stott. He outlines kind of a very classical view, relies heavily on Turretin on this and others before him. And I think it makes sense for PSA. One of the main things that I did when I was looking at it just purely through the lens of divine wrath was, and divine wrath as retributive justice, is that it just occurred to me that if we're not going to talk about punishing Christ and that we're going to talk about Christ taking on penal consequences, which is a reasonable shift based off of all the concerns about punishing an innocent, then I'm not quite sure how that satisfies retributive justice. And if retributive justice is essential to the doctrine, which it is, retributive justice demands that the offender gets their just desert. And there are a number of principles, but the main one salient for this discussion is that not only is it a guilty offender who previously committed an offense, but the offender receives punishment in proportionality to their offense, right? They must be punished. A guilty person must be punished. And so when we talk about penal consequences, we're certainly not saying that Christ is punished, because in this form, he's innocent. And in that case, I'm not quite sure how retributive principles are satisfied, that it's actually a relaxation of retributive principles. And we're saying that retribution asks for this, for a punishment, which penal consequences isn't. But in the case of Christ, Christ only endures the penal consequences. So it is a relaxation of retributive justice. And I argue it's actually a form of mercy, and which is interesting to me because a lot of PSA traditionally says the cross is the purest expression of God's love or God's mercy and God's justice, right? But we have... I'm not quite sure how that's true, but if we're talking about a relaxation of God's retributive principles in the case of Christ for the salvation of sinners, I think that is mercy and not the satisfaction of retributive justice. So, yeah.
The question I had as a follow-up is totally going out of the window because I don't remember what it was. I had something 30 seconds ago, and now it's gone. Jacob, did you have any closing questions that you definitely wanted to ask?
I want to follow up on a lot of things, but not necessarily ones that I think need to be on air.
We can chat later. That's okay.
I do remember a funny note that where you mentioned Craig is relying heavily on Turretin, and I imagine a lot of our more classically inclined listeners are like, he relies on Turretin? I had no idea.
Well, I think one of the weaknesses of Craig's book is that, you know, it is in some respects divorced from a lot of the classical theistic and reformed ideas that sometimes put boundaries around PSA. And I think that he struggles in other respects because he doesn't have those resources to rely on, but we're not interviewing him.
All right. So Danny, remind me, so if people want to follow along with your work and keep up with any new publications that you have, is there a place they can go to do that?
Oh, I'm painfully terrible about this. And my current site, it needs to be updated. Is the bad answer no?
No, that is a common answer, unfortunately.
Oh, it is? Oh, that's good. Okay. I'm technically on Facebook, but I don't do anything on Facebook. But you can find me at the Cross Training Fellowship through Birmingham if you want to see But yeah, I have the St. Andrews page if you want to look me up on St. Andrews.
And so if you're listening to this far in the future, hopefully we'll have the dissertation published in a book form at some point somewhere. Right. So whenever that happens, I will do my best to remember to come in and drop the link in the show notes. So if you're a late listener to the episode, you can have a link to it. But I say that I'm going to do that, and then I totally forget almost every time. So somebody just email me and tell me, please add the link so that it's there. But Danny, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. It's always fun to learn more, and I think you've done some really, really interesting and helpful work here. So thanks for the labors on this, and thanks for taking the time with us. And for everybody who's been listening, thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Percent of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.